Today, we've heard a lot from women about fighting sexism, misogyny, and gender-based violence. But when are we going to hear from more men? The killing of Sarah Everard sparked thousands of conversations about the treatment of women by men.
Every single time you go into a bar, a man's touching you, groping you, offering to buy you.
You have to take a certain route.
Get in Hong Kong for a run, you have to take a certain route.
With headphones on late at night.
I remember as a safe warrior,
the first time.
If I don't do this, it makes me uncomfortable.
Like, at this stage, I've got like an indelible ink spray. I've got keys between my fingers
to work out. If I say no to this person,
are they going to be a
go-off?
Are they
going to stop them?
There were conversations that appeared to be taking place overwhelmingly among women. Why do you think men have not been more involved in this conversation?
I think a lot of men don't know what to say. I think a lot of men get defensive and they let their defensiveness guide their actions or their inactions. I think a lot of men have this naive notion that if they themselves aren't perpetrators, that somehow this isn't their issue. And I often analogize that to say, like, that's as sophisticated as saying if you're a white person and you don't enact overtly racist behaviors against people of color, then racism is not really an issue for you.
Jackson Katz is an activist and author working to promote gender equality and prevent gender violence.
This is not just about individual perpetrators. This is a systemic social problem with deep roots in the culture and belief systems and ideologies about gender and entitlement and power and men's dominance and everything else. And all men play a role in perpetuating those systems. And so we have to figure out how they can play a more constructive role.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, men's role in the fight against misogyny. I hear you are constantly asked how you got interested in this field and that you find that quite funny. How come?
Well, people often ask me and other men who speak out about men's violence against women, why do you care so much about this subject? Isn't this really a women's concern? And there's typically a subtext to the question. I think a lot of people think, oh, there must have been something that happened in his life. There must have been a woman close to him. Maybe he grew up in a home with domestic violence. Maybe his wife or daughter was sexually assaulted in some fashion. And maybe that explains why he's so passionate. And my response to that is, if all it took for men to speak out on these matters was having a close woman in their life who has been the victim or survivor of some sort of sexual or domestic violence at the hands of men, if that's all it took, there would be billions of men involved in this work. I think the bigger question is, why aren't there more men involved with this? And what are some of the social factors and forces at work to keep men silent about this? Because I believe there's tons of men who really care about women and who care about justice and fairness and nonviolence, but very few men have distinguished themselves publicly in any serious way around this subject matter.
Okay, so the question shouldn't be, why are men like you interested in working in this field? But why are so many men not? But presumably, there are experiences that led you in this direction. What were they?
I was a university student, 19 years old, and I remember enjoying my freedom greatly, coming and going as I pleased from parties 3 or 4 in the morning and not worrying about my personal safety. And then women on my floor had a completely different experience of their freedom of movement based on the fear of sexual violence, especially at night, but not exclusively at night. And I remember thinking, if I were a woman and I had to live like that, I had to worry constantly about who I was going home with, what time it was, I'm at a party, or do I have a ride home? I remember thinking how ticked off I would be about that. And then I was a student journalist and I was set to cover this rally that a group of women students had organized for better lighting on campus because there had been a couple of rapes on my campus and they had been outside in a parking lot. And I remember as I walked up to this protest, I thought, why is it only women out there? The vast majority of rape is committed by men. you know, whether the victims are female or male or now beyond the binary, it's like the overwhelming majority of perpetrators are men. And yet the vast majority of men are not rapists, but there's no men out there protesting. It was like, seemed obvious to me that that was a problem. And then I talked to the women in my life at the time, and I started realizing I had never thought about really women's experience, both of sexism, but in particular of vulnerability to men's violence. And by the way, at the same time all this was happening, I was also a young white person who was understanding racism really for the first time. And then as a heterosexual person, again, all of it was both academically and intellectually, but also personally and socially transformative for me. And I just went out and started using whatever skills and advantages I had. And I'm doing the same thing as a late middle-aged man as I started doing when I was a young university student. My hair is shorter now and I have better clothing, but I think the message is the same.
And I know you've argued that as you've carried on in this sector, you've seen that there is bias everywhere, including in our language, about violence against women. What do you mean by that?
You'll hear people say things like, how many women were raped on university campuses last year, rather than how many men raped women. You'll hear people say things like, how many girls in this school were sexually harassed last year, rather than how many boys sexually harassed girls, or how many girls sexually harassed girls. You'll hear people say things like, how many teenage girls got pregnant last year, rather than how many men and boys impregnated teenage girls. Even the term violence against women is problematic. I don't even use the term without problematizing it, because think about it. The term violence against women is a passive construction. There's no active agent in the sentence. It's a bad thing that happens to women, violence against them, but nobody's doing it. They're just experiencing it, kind of like the weather. But if you insert the active agent, men, you have a new phrase, men's violence against women. It doesn't roll off the tongue as easily, but it's more accurate and it's more honest. Passive voice is really pervasive in the discussions about men's violence against women, which shifts accountability off of the group who is committing or perpetrating the vast majority of the violence and puts it onto the group experiencing it. I think that using passive language in the way that I've articulated is a form of subtle but profound victim blaming, because essentially calling rape a women's issue means that, okay, it's about women. Women need to be responsible for doing all the work that needs to be done to change the culture. Meanwhile, men are the ones who are doing it. So why is it a women's issue?
Good point. And you caught me out. I used violence against women in the question. And presumably such passive language also puts men off engaging in the conversation and means we're not focusing on the perpetrators, which is presumably what we have to do to try to change things.
That's right. Focusing on the perpetrator and the society that produces the perpetrator. The solution to these problems is not running from one broken man or pathological individual or abuser to the next and trying to figure out what went wrong in his life. That is such a naive approach to what is a systematic social problem. And if we as a society are serious about addressing this, it is going to require a level of introspection on the part of men, as well as, of course, women and others, not just as individuals, but as members of a society that are promoting a set of values and ideas about manhood, about power and control, about sexual entitlement, about any number of things. And that level of introspection is itself challenging and sometimes threatening. And I think part of the reason why men, in a broader sense, haven't really engaged with this subject matter very much is because either consciously or unconsciously, I think a lot of men get this. They know that this is not just about sick, pathological individuals. It's a much deeper systematic problem, which means that all of us have a role to play in either perpetuating it or resisting it. And the resistance part is threatening because it does require a level of introspection.
Okay, so when we're thinking about how men should respond to all of this, I guess there are two roles. One is, how do people behave themselves? But the other is, how do they act around each other? You describe that as being a bystander. What do you mean by that?
If you yourself are not abusive towards women and girls, okay, but that's not enough. That's kind of a low bar for what we consider to be a good man in the 21st century, that you're not an abuser, okay? It's kind of a low bar. But if you're a man or a young man and you have friends, you have teammates, you have guys you hang with, you have colleagues, And you see them acting out in ways that you know are problematic, making sexist comments, degrading comments about women. If you don't say something and make it clear that their sexism or their misogyny is not acceptable, then in a sense, isn't your silence a form of consent and complicity in their sexism, in their misogyny? And don't we know that misogyny and sexism and men's violence against women are not just about pathological individuals, but they are individuals who are acting on deeper and underlying inequalities and social norms and ideologies about gender and sexuality and such. And if you participate in perpetuating those beliefs, aren't you perpetuating the behaviors as well? Like, for example, you're a 15-year-old boy and your friend tells a rape joke and you think that's not funny. Instead of not saying anything, what about saying to your friend, you know, dude, what you just said is kind of uncool, or I'm uncomfortable with that joke, or could you joke about something else, or whatever you can say within your comfort level. That is incredibly powerful. If we got boys, young men, and men to start challenging and interrupting other men's enactment of sexist beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors, we would make an incredible impact on shifting the culture.
Obviously, that would be a great thing. But as you said within there, you said within someone's comfort zone. And in a way, isn't it easy to say that? But sometimes in reality, quite hard. Because, for example, calling out your boss may cost you your job, or getting kids to call out other kids might affect their popularity. Calling out a relative might open you up to being ridiculed. I mean, these are quite challenging conversations to have, aren't they?
They are. I'm not naive about this. I understand there's all kinds of pressures on men in general, and this crosses class, race, ethnicity, religion, to remain silent. And by the way, this has to happen in a collective group experience. It's not just individuals on their own. Guys have to hear other guys say, yeah, I was in a situation like that, and you know, I didn't say something, or I did do this. And other guys need to hear that other guys are struggling with this, because I think individual guys often think that they're the only one in a given peer culture who's uncomfortable with the behavior of some of the individuals in that group. But in fact, I think oftentimes a lot of guys are uncomfortable.
So give me some examples of what men can do.
Well, everything is contextual. So everybody has to think about their comfort level, the situation. Are they trying to maintain relationships? Or are they willing to risk relationships? So we can never tell people, this is what you need to do in this situation. We can only help them to think through their ethical obligations to each other and to themselves, and then help them think through a range of possible choices that they might make. The only advice that I and we teach is don't do nothing, because doing nothing is the only choice that I think is a bad choice. But what you do affirmatively can vary according to so many different forces and factors. For example, it's a group of three guys are out having a drink after work. And one of the guys at the bar makes an inappropriate sexual comment about a woman who's been recently hired in the office. What do you do? What do you say? And if you don't say something, what are you saying? Do you have a responsibility to this woman, even if you don't really know her? She just started working. You know, what are the potential negative consequences for a woman who's trying to be taken seriously as a professional and having a group of guys in her office talking about her like this? What's your responsibility to him, the guy who just said it? He might be your friend. What's your responsibility to yourself? In other words, if you're a person who says, I am an ethical person who, when I see injustice, I'm going to speak up. I'm not going to walk in the other direction. Well, how does that apply to this situation? And then the question is, what do you do? And if you don't say something right in that moment, does that mean you've lost the opportunity? No, it doesn't. There's other potential interventions. So, for example, maybe take the guy aside tomorrow or the next day and say, look, I really like you and I like working with you, but dude, there's something you said the other night out at the bar, and I just wanted to say I was a little uncomfortable. I didn't know what to say, but you really shouldn't be talking like that. Now, the other guy clearly hears that there are people watching him, that there are people who are concerned about him, that are on to the fact that he's doing something that might not be appropriate. And imagine how different our societies would look if more men would do what I just said.
Right. So speaking up at work when you hear inappropriate or sexist behavior, what about relationships and friends?
How about you're a young guy and you hanging out with a guy friend and you're seeing him constantly texting his girlfriend and you're concerned that it's not just that he's in love, but that he's obsessed with her. He's obsessed with knowing where she is, who she's with, what she's wearing, in a way that makes you uncomfortable. What do you do? If he's acting this way in front of you, how might he be acting in private? And is it possible that his behavior could be the beginnings of more abusive behavior. And by the way, anybody who knows anything about relationship abuse knows that controlling behaviors start somewhere. All of a sudden, a guy doesn't just murder his wife, okay? There's a long pattern of behavior. And if you catch it early, you're much more likely to be effective. Another really important point that I did not mention earlier is that when it comes to something on the street or in the tube or in some other social or public setting where people don't know each other, there's a whole different set of metrics you have to apply and decision-making processes you have to apply, because there's often real physical danger that you face if you intervene publicly in situations where you don't know the people. When it comes to people you know, the dangers are most often social rather than physical.
You know, you've talked a lot about helping others, whether it's children or peers, and calling out others. But what are the behaviours that men may be doing that they think are normal, which are in fact contributing to the problem? What if the problem is you?
I think the fundamental issue here is about the responsibility of people with certain kind of social advantages to do introspection, to do self-criticism, to look inward, to think about how their attitudes, beliefs, and behaviors might be helping to perpetuate unfairness, inequality, or injustice, and then figure out how they can be part of the solution. I'm not saying this is an easy process. People are often very defensive, and I think in particular, men who are progressive politically, who are engaged with thinking critically about structural inequality and deindustrialization and income inequality and post-colonial realities, this understanding about gender inequality has to be marbled into all of these larger systemic analyses of what's happening in the world. But I think what happens, even for a lot of men on the left, is that they're uncomfortable with this particular subject matter, in part because gender is personal, because the personal is political, and this implicates people's own relationships, their own division of labor within the household, in heterosexual couples. I mean, this gets really close to home. But I would never say that I've got this all figured out for myself, that I have no sexism in my own psyche or in my bones or something. It's like I'm working on it too. And also another way of thinking about this is about the difference between guilt and responsibility. You'll hear a lot of men say, oh, this is just male guilt. I resent that. And you'll hear white people say the same thing about racism. It's like, I don't feel guilty for being a man, okay? I was born who I am. I don't feel guilty for being white. I feel responsible as a man in an incredibly sexist world with incredible levels of men's abuse, harassment, and violence against women. I feel responsible as a white person in a racist society to work against racism, or I can't look myself in the mirror. It's not about guilt, it's about responsibility. And I think that's an incredibly important distinction that we need to make when we try to engage men in this process.
Are there behaviors that men may be perpetuating without even realizing they're doing anything wrong?
Absolutely. I mean, a common one is sexualizing women in non-sexual situations, whether it's in the workplace or other situations when women want to be treated as full human beings and not reduced to sort of the objects of heterosexual men's sexual desire in some fashion. By the way, this is one of the challenges of growing up as a man in a culture that's absolutely awash in the sexual objectification of women. And by the way, that includes pornography culture. Pornography is so incredibly influential in socializing boys and young men and men into a way of thinking about sexuality and heterosexuality that is so misogynist and so abusive towards women. I've read some of the statistics in the UK recently about just how common sexual aggressive behavior is in normative sexual practice. And then you look at the porn culture and the vast majority of porn that's targeted towards men in a heterosexual sense is openly misogynist. And it's not a mutual experience and mutual pleasure. It's men doing something to women and often calling them names and aggressing upon them, putting their hands around their throat, which is strangulation. It's unbelievable how normalized some of these behaviors have been.
And on the question of defensiveness, on male fragility, if you like, the idea that not all men are like that and they don't want all men to be tarred with that same brush. How do you respond to that?
Men who say not all men in response to women's concerns, women's anger, women's self-righteous indignation about the level of sexism and sexual assault and violation that they have to live with. If you have the impulse to say not all men, then hold on to it. Don't say it. it makes you sound like an ass. It makes you sound like you're defensive. It makes you sound like you're ignorant. It makes you sound like you're not listening to what the women are saying. Of course it's not all men. Everybody knows it's not all men who do this. It's a silly thing to say, so don't say it.
Does that mean that men need to be aware of male privilege?
Absolutely. So I'll give you an example of an exercise that I designed over 30 years ago, based on feminist educational practices that have been developed in the 70s and 80s. It's old school. We have a chalkboard. We put a line down the middle and put a male symbol on one side, female symbol on the other. And I asked the guys, what steps do you take every day to prevent yourselves from being sexually assaulted? And I and my colleagues have done this exercise literally thousands of times. And we only have a handful or two of examples of men's responses to that question. Let me just say, I know, and we all know, that men are sexually assaulted, most cases by other men. But in a public space, very few men say that on a daily basis, this is what I do to avoid sexual assault. And then we ask the same exact question of the women. The board fills up rapidly, whether it's an urban, suburban, or rural area. And women do a ton of things every single day. Holding the keys is a potential weapon. Don't take a first floor apartment. Shut the windows even on a warm summer night. Look guys in the eye when you're walking by them on the street. Don't look guys in the eyes when you're walking down the street. Don't wear headphones when you're jogging. I mean, there's hundreds of them that women do, right? And men don't even have to think about this. And women are constantly ordering their daily life around this. This is an obvious structural disadvantage. But what's going on, for example, in the UK? Do you have systematic education around this subject matter from kindergarten on through high school and into university? I don't think so. So talk about an example of a systematic political, social change that needs to happen. It's not just individual young men need to challenge their friends who tell rape jokes. It's a much bigger problem and much bigger challenge.
Coming up, why is it that perpetrators of sexual violence are overwhelmingly likely to be men? Just on identity questions, how does all of this interact with race and sexuality, for example?
Well, that's a big and important question. There's so many ways. Integrating race and ethnicity and religion and gender and sexuality and all that stuff within the context of these issues is an incredibly important thing. We can't just posit like a one-size-fits-all solution, or we can't assume a homogenous social landscape. There's going to be differences between people. There's going to be hierarchy within peer cultures that race and ethnicity sometimes affects. I'll give you an example from here in the States, and I'm sure there's an analog in the UK. When we do bystander training, one of the things that young Black men will say about why they might not and likely would not intervene in a situation like in a party situation where they see some potential dangerous scenario developing, is that they're worried that if somehow law enforcement is called, the law enforcement could come in and think that they're the perpetrator, not the good person who's trying to help out, and then they could be in personal risk. Now, how many white men have that as an excuse or a reason why they don't intervene? Most white guys never even think about that. They think about all kinds of other reasons why they might not say anything or do anything, but not the police might show up and think I'm the perpetrator. That's an example of how talking honestly about race and ethnicity as it intersects with this subject matter is just doing justice to the reality of the multiracial world that we live in.
Interesting. And obviously we're talking about male violence because it's violence carried out overwhelmingly by men. Do we know why that is?
Well, I would say that it's something about how we define manhood. If it was genetic, then why are the rates of violence radically different between different societies and even within subcultures in the same society? Why do the rates of violence vary according to what time period we're in? It's not about some inevitable genetic inheritance that we have as primates, although I'm not averse to thinking about the ways in which our primate nature might have some contribution to this, but wildly overriding any sort of genetic imperative is social structure, political structure, and the ideologies and beliefs about manhood. If we continue to understand that to be masculine means to be powerful, in control of yourself and others, of entitlement vis-a-vis women, including sexual entitlement, if we're training boys from the earliest ages that part of being a man means being, you're the one in charge, you're the one in control, your needs come first, your physical and sexual needs come first. If that's how we're training boys and men, we shouldn't be then throwing up our hands and saying, how is this happening? How is all this violence happening? And in fact, to frame this positively, Anushka?
Yeah.
We need to change our definition of strength, because even the conversation that we're having and the things that I'm saying, some people will hear this, especially, you know, political conservatives and others. They'll say, oh, you're just talking about making men soft. In the United States, on the Fox News channel, they have this term wussification.
It's time to toughen up. I could talk about the wussification of America, wussification of American men. This is it. I got a paddle in high school. I did something wrong once in gym, and they take a paddle. It's a sawed-off bat, a flat on one side, and they whack you in the butt across the back of the legs. I'll tell you what, I never messed around in that class again.
Wimps and wussies deliver mediocrity, and men win. And what America's always been about is winning. So I think it's pivotal to the health of the country.
So they constantly come back to this idea that the wussification of America is one of our biggest social problems.
God.
It's one of the reasons why Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, because millions of Americans think that men have become soft and the culture has become, quote unquote, wussified. And what I'm saying and what feminists have been saying is not that we need men to be soft. It's that we want men to be strong. But we have to define strength differently. Instead of defining strength as the imposition of your will against another person through force or the threat of force, what about expanding our definition of strength to include things like moral courage, social courage, saying the right thing or doing the right thing even when no one is watching, taking a risk by challenging or interrupting your friend's enactment of sexism, even though it's going to be an awkward situation. In fact, I often think this idea that men who speak out on these matters are soft and weak is totally topsy-turvy. Going along with the guys, if you're a guy, takes absolutely nothing special. What takes something special is if you turn to them and say, this is not okay, and yet the guy who turns to them and says that is seen as the soft one. This is so ridiculous.
So are you hopeful things could change?
We have an enormous possibility in front of us, because I think there's a whole generation of young men who are coming of age who are engaging with women in their personal lives, in their professional lives, in multiracial settings and multiethnic settings in the UK, in the United States, all over the world, who want to do this better than their fathers and grandfathers' generations did it. And honestly, there's no other choice, really. The status quo is totally unacceptable. And as long as women are pushing and saying the status quo is unacceptable, what am I going to do? Just run, you know, under our desks and hide, cower in a defensive crouch? Does that seem like a reasonable and rational response to the moment? I don't think so. And I think there's a way to frame this in a positive, aspirational way to men. Like, look, guys, we have an opportunity to step up. It's about time.
Jackson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Anushka.
That was Jackson Katz, an activist and author who co-founded Mentors in Violence Prevention, one of the longest-running gender violence prevention programs in North America, which works within sports and the military, as well as many other areas. You can look Jackson up on YouTube as well. He did a brilliant TED Talk on this subject, and he is the author of The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. And if you haven't heard them, then do listen back to two episodes we put out last week on this issue. One on why women were so angry in the wake of the killing of Sarah Everard with Alexandra Topping, and another on femicide and why the killing of women by men is so common with Yvonne Roberts and Helen Pidd. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.